Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Think of Ben Bernanke as the little Dutch boy, the kid with his finger in the dike. He now has this dilemma. How does he pull that finger out of the American economy without bad things happening? He will be making his case to a skeptical Congress this week. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Progressive Insurance, with more than 30,000 local independent agents. Information available at progressive.com. And by PBS, presenting Faces of America with Henry Louis Gates Jr., Meryl Streep, and Stephen Colbert, who dig into their family trees Wednesday at 8, 7 Central on PBS.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Good to have you here on this Monday, everybody. It is the 8th of February today. Assuming the streets of Washington, D.C. are clear of snow by then, and there is another big storm on the way, Ben Bernanke is scheduled to trudge up Capitol Hill later this week. On the face of it, it's going to be just one more round of congressional testimony from the Fed chairman. But there are some expectations that he will use his public remarks over the next few weeks to start laying the groundwork for what might be the Fed's trickiest bet yet, getting all that money it plowed into the American economy safely out. From Washington, Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genzer reports.
When times are tough, the Fed pumps extra money into the banking system. That keeps interest rates low for struggling businesses and consumers. For the past 2 years, the Fed has been raining money down on the economy. It's piled up like the snow now covering Washington. Soon it'll be time to start shoveling.
The Fed has covered the economy with a deep blanket of reserves. That might have been appropriate for sometimes, but at some point it's going to have to dig that out.
Vincent Reinhardt is a former Fed economist, now with the American Enterprise Institute. He says the Fed will eventually need to shovel up the excess money it's created. Congress has given the Fed a new tool, the authority to set the interest rates it pays to banks. The hope is they'll park more cash in Fed accounts. Ken Kuttner teaches economics at Williams College.
The Fed is simply trying to say, hey, instead of keeping the money in your mattress, give it to me, we'll take care of it. And in doing so, there'll be less of it sloshing around in the system.
Now, when there's less available cash, interest rates go up. Loans are harder to get. That cools the economy and prevents inflation. But wait a minute. Aren't we in the middle of a credit crunch? Why would the Fed want to make loans harder to get now? Catherine Mann teaches economics at Brandeis. She says Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke is using his testimony before Congress to send investors a signal that he won't let the economy recover too quickly.
Bernanke wants to make very clear that the Federal Reserve has both the commitment as well as the tools to ensure that inflation does not get out of control.
Now, if banks are parking their excess cash at the Fed instead of loaning it to you, interest rates will go up. Because of that, you'll get a better rate on your savings account, but mortgage rates could go up a bit, and businesses could pay more for short-term loans. The economy has to be well on the way to recovery before the Fed puts on the brakes, though, and economists don't expect that to happen until later this year. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall Genzer for Marketplace.
Commodities did a little better today than they were doing at the end of last week. Oil nudged up a bit, back to almost $72 a barrel. The euro edged higher against the dollar. Europe's single currency took a shellacking last week on the foreign exchange markets amid worries about budget deficits over there. There was some tough talk on that topic over the weekend at a big finance meeting in Canada, and it does seem to have calmed currency traders just a bit. But as Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports from the European desk in London, markets usually like action, not so much words.
European finance ministers assured the G7 meeting that Europe would deal with its deficits, but there was no concrete plan of action. Currency dealers continue to fret over the debt of Eurozone countries like Greece. They fear that Athens might actually default, and that fear is undermining the single currency, says Graham Mather of the European Policy Forum.
The danger for the euro itself is that the market anxieties about the Greek public accounts could make people lose confidence in bonds, other things denominated in euros.
Few observers believe that the Greeks will be able to sort out their public finances on their own. Too much austerity is likely to provoke severe unrest. Daniel Hannan is a member of the European Parliament, and he says there's only one serious solution.
The only way for the euro to hold together is if there is effectively a bailout of the Greek economy by essentially German taxpayers.
But when Germany adopted the euro 10 years ago, German taxpayers were promised they would never have to bail out the weaker economies to the south. Some long-term critics of the single currency, like Professor Tim Congdon, say this could be the beginning of the end of a project that was always doomed to failure.
It's never really been done before. Usually you have, you know, one country, one government, one central bank, one currency. Instead, we've got, you know, one currency and 16 governments. I've been amazed it's continued this long.
Most analysts say the euro will survive. Its collapse would cause turmoil in Europe, which Germany would be determined to avoid. The stakes are high. The choices are hard. Over the next few weeks, the euro faces the fight of its life. In London, this is Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
MGM Mirage has chosen Asia over Atlantic City. The casino company said today it's going to hold on to its profitable venture in Macau, China, and try to unload its stake in a billion-dollar casino in Jersey. MGM is under some pressure from New Jersey gaming regulators. They say its partner in Macau has links to Chinese organized crime syndicates. So, faced with the option of unloading the Chinese or the New Jersey one, MGM is sticking with China. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman reports.
New Jersey's gaming agency ruled last spring that MGM Mirage would have to stop operating in the state or cut ties to its Macau partner, Pansy Ho. That's because of her father's roots in China's gambling industry, says I. Nelson Rose of Whittier Law School and the University of Macau.
Her father, Stanley Ho, is one of the wealthiest men in the world, and there were always some rumors that there might be connections with organized crime.
Nevada regulators checked and cleared those connections, letting the company's joint ownership of the MGM Grand Macau go forward.
Nevada doesn't particularly see something wrong if there's allegations about a father, where New Jersey is always trying to be super strict and super clean.
New Jersey has painted the company into a corner, says Bill Thompson of the University of Nevada. It's in debt for a big Las Vegas development, and business at its Atlantic City casino, the Borgata, is down.
With the onset of competition from Pennsylvania, table games in Maryland, Delaware, they say, let's stay in Macau, let's get out of New Jersey. We have to sell something anyway. Good timing. Get rid of the Borgata.
And the Macau market, it's now bigger than Atlantic City and Nevada combined. Revenues in January were up 65%. A spokesman for MGM Mirage told Marketplace the company continues to work toward a solution in New Jersey. That's while also pursuing divestiture of its Atlantic City properties. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Up the East Coast on Wall Street today, that thin hold traders had on Dow 10,000 went slipping right through their fingers. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Miley Cyrus has decided to do her part for Haiti relief. Disney's Hannah Montana announced today that she has organized a celebrity online auction to raise money for earthquake victims. Bidders could win some of her leftover party dresses or a tour of the set for Hugh Jackman's new movie, that kind of thing. Interesting, sure, but not news in and of itself. Until you get down to the bottom of the press release, where it says that proceeds will go to the American Red Cross. More than $640 million has been raised for Haiti so far. The biggest aid agencies, like the Red Cross, have gotten most of it. This week, the Chronicle of Philanthropy explores some ways that that money might be distributed more widely. Stacey Palmer is the editor of the Chronicle. Welcome to the program.
Good to join you.
What happens when the biggest aid groups get the biggest chunk of the money?
What happens is that everybody who didn't get the money would like a share of it. And so there's beginning to be some squabbles now that so much money has been donated. And everybody is good at doing different kinds of things. So there are questions about whether the right organizations are getting the money, and how does an average donor even know who's the best organization to support?
And there has been a call, hasn't there, for this pooling of donations, for everything to go to one big group, and then that group parses it out.
Right. That's a solution that some other countries use, where everybody gives to one coordinated fund. It's sort of like the United Way works, where everybody puts the money in and then some experts decide where to go. But there are always criticisms of those kinds of things, because who are the experts? Who decides where it goes? So there's a lot of competition in that respect, too.
Well, we'll do the downsides in a second, but let's get the upsides. I mean, what are the positives to having one group collect all the money and then dish it out?
If one group could collect all the money, it wouldn't be based just on how great a group is at marketing its message and getting all those ads out there. But instead, it might be, I've got an application process. We've got a group of experts reviewing and saying, these are the biggest needs in this disaster, and these are the groups that are best at doing it, and they would parse out the money.
Okay, so now back to the downsides and those experts you were talking about. That's kind of a scary term when somebody else, some other expert, decides how you get to do what you do, right?
That's one of the problems, who gets to decide. But one of the concerns is that it could take a lot of time to get these donations out, because the experts are going to have to vet them all. But also, every time that that dollar has to pass through different hands, first it goes to the pooled group, then it goes down to other people to pass it out eventually to the recipient, you lose some of that money along the way. And so nobody wants to see that happen.
Let's look at a real life example. The telethon for Haiti that George Clooney ran a week or so ago, they decided to pool all their donations, right? And they're distributing it?
Exactly. So they've gathered together a bunch of experts, and they're figuring out which groups decide to get the money. And the Clinton-Bush initiative is pooling the money. So you can give to them, and then they're going to decide which groups are going. So there are a couple of different options for people who want to decide to give to the pooled fund versus giving to the groups that they know about, like Red Cross.
Over the long term then, Stacey, I mean, which one of these would work better, do you think?
I think the pooled model might be able to get to more of the different kinds of needs. There are lots of things happening that people might not think so much about when they think about relief. They think about hunger and shelter, but there are other kinds of things that are needed. Haiti needs a lot more trees because everybody's moving out to the countryside and the erosion is bad. The agriculture is bad. It's not going to be able to sustain people. So there are lots of amputees. People are going to need handicapped assistance. That's one of the sad things that happened about this disaster. So those are the kinds of concerns that don't get publicity, but that a pooled fund might think about.
Well, then, Stacey, what do we do next time? Next time there's this huge event that happens, people need help, and Americans, you know, pull out their checkbooks. What do we do?
The best thing to do is to give an immediate donation to whatever charity you trust, but hold back some of that money and think about those needs that are coming long term. Think about it a little bit like your portfolio. You're going to give some of it to the most immediate needs, and then you're going to think a little bit about long term. So you don't need to do it all right away. You can do some research, figure out what the best groups are. And if you're not sure, give to one of these pooled funds or ask some kind of expert. There's loads of advice on the internet right now that's very, very good and very helpful.
Stacey Palmer. She's the editor of the Chronicle of Philanthropy. Stacey, thanks a lot for coming in.
Thank you.
I'm no football purist, but I was decidedly in the minority at the Super Bowl gathering at my house yesterday. Every time I tried to fast forward through the commercials on the theory that, gee, I don't know, let's watch the game, not the ads, I was roundly shouted down by the crowd, which is why I know more about some of those ads than I would care to, especially one for the carmaker Kia. Marketplace's Rico Galliano explains why it stood out.
The ad features a group of children's dolls piled in the back seat of a Kia SUV. The toys come to life and party like rock stars. The message? A family car can still be fun. But much of the ad's appeal is the dolls themselves, several of which are available now at your local toy store. It's a product placement within another product's ad.
It's not unheard of.
That's Marissa Gluck of Radar Research. She points out a popular MasterCard ad famously featured other companies' mascots, like Mr. Clean and Count Chocula. But while that ad appealed to baby boomer nostalgia, Gluck says the Kia ad tries to hook a broader audience by including old-school icons like a sock monkey and a new-school character from the Nickelodeon cartoon Yo Gabba Gabba.
I think they're hoping that there's a bit of a reflected glow from those brand icons. Yo Gabba Gabba has a pretty strong 20-something, 30-something following, not just young parents.
So Kia gets the reflected brand glow, but what's in it for those other brands? Wildbrain, the company that produces Yo Gabba Gabba, says they got a licensing payment from Kia. But for Susan Pritchett, Super Bowl exposure was payment enough. Pritchett's the co-founder of a little doll-making company called Blah Blah. Kia featured their mop like Mr. X doll in the ad.
They didn't license. We just were glad for the opportunity to be seen and our dolls to be seen by 100 million people or more.
So far, Blah Blah's seen only a small sales bump, but
we expect to have a huge effect and people knowing our brand more.
With the help of reporters like me, no doubt.
With reporters like you, yes.
Just fulfilling my role in the Super Bowl ad ecosystem, I'm Rico Galliano for Marketplace. Coming up, private colleges try to appeal to all.
Yet the stereotypes persist that the private colleges are only for wealthy kids. It's simply not true.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials closed below 10,000 for the first time since November. It lost 103 points, 1%, ended at 99.08. The NASDAQ gave back 15 points, 7/10%, finished at 21.26. The S&P 500 trimmed 9 points, nearly 9/10%. Closed at 1,056. The idea that rising sovereign debt in the Eurozone might force banks here to raise capital and dilute share values drove bank stocks down. Bank of America bit off 3.5%. J.P. Morgan Chase chased away about 1.5%. Citigroup lost more than 2%. Not everybody had a bad day, though. Hasbro wound up 12%. The toy company beat estimates when it reported a 77% jump in fourth quarter profits. The price on the 10-year T-note fell. That pushed the yield up 3.57%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by the Nightly Business Report on PBS and its special series on investor psychology, Your Mind and Your Money, Mondays on Nightly Business Report. Sustainability coverage is supported in part by the Candida Fund, furthering values that contribute to a healthy planet. Throughout the trading day, we're talking business and the economy on our blog, The Scratchpad. Check in with online host Scott Jagow and join the discussion at marketplace.org.
Here's a look at the Marketplace Datebook for events coming up Tuesday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on wholesale trade for December. On Capitol Hill, the Joint Economic Committee holds a hearing on job creation and economic growth. And singer-songwriter Carole King celebrates her 68th birthday. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. Most everybody has lost economic ground over the past 2 years or so. But before the recession and the financial crisis and the wealth destruction that they brought, people in the upper reaches of society were proportionately way better off than most of the rest of the country, while over the past decade or two, everybody else has been figuring out how to get by with less. Dan Ariely pulled more than 10,000 people, including via our website, some of you, to discover how we all feel about the ever-increasing U.S. wealth gap. Dan, it's good to talk to you again.
Same here, as always.
So it is the haves and the have-nots, a little wealth distribution that you've been looking at?
Yes, and the first thing I should tell you is that you don't have any people listening to you.
To this show?
Yeah, only about 600 people filled up the survey.
Oh, well, all right, so it's actually 601, because you got to count my mom.
Okay. All right. So aside from the fact that not many people are listening, or at least not many people filled the survey, here is the question that we're interested in. The philosopher Rawls proposed a long time ago that a fair society is a society that if you knew everything about it, you'll be willing to join it in a random place in a distribution. Mm-hmm. You would be willing to toss the dice and put you in one in one bin of wealth, for example.
Mm-hmm.
So we posed people two questions. We said, what do you think the wealth distribution in the U.S. is,
mm-hmm.
and what do you think is the ideal wealth distribution?
So in other words, what do they think in the United States now, who has most of the money, and then what ought it be, right?
That's right. And what happened is that, first of all, people dramatically underestimate the wealth inequality in the U.S.
Underestimate. So the fact of the matter is that fewer people have more of the money.
That's right. So if you look at the whole world in terms of wealth distribution, we are kind of between, you know, before the recession, I don't have data about after the recession, yeah. but before the recessions, we were basically between the Western world and South America. We were the most skewed distribution of the Western world in terms of the haves and the have-nots. But now the more interesting question is, what do people think it should be?
Yeah.
And what we found was that actually there's a huge agreement between people in terms of what it should be. And this happened to both your listeners and the general sample population. You would take, for example, Republicans and Democrats,
mm-hmm.
and you would think that they would vary dramatically, and they don't. I mean, they differ, but they don't differ so much. So you take Republicans, and they basically agree with Democrats. You take people with low income versus high income, they basically agree.
Can you quantify what we have right now? I mean, what percentage of people have what percent of the wealth?
Right now, the top 20% of the people have about 85% of
right.
the wealth.
Right.
People think that they only own 68% of the wealth, so mm-hmm. people underestimate the inequity.
Mm-hmm.
But if you ask them what's kind of an ideal world in a Rawls kind of sense that you would actually want to participate in, they say 33%. So they say in an ideal world, we want the top 20% to own more than 20%. We want them to be wealthier, but we want them to own about 33% of the wealth.
That's so interesting. They still want the rich to be rich, but just not as rich?
Yeah, you know, actually, rich to be rich is a perfectly reasonable idea, right? I mean, people that have money can create jobs, they create factories. So there is benefit in non-equal distributions of wealth. The question is, what is the ideal?
I'm stuck in the idea that there is a segment of the society out there that thinks that inequality is the way it ought to be.
Yeah, and, you know, everybody thinks inequality is the way to be. And the main lesson for me from this whole study
mm-hmm.
is that when we look at the political arena, right. we kind of have this huge polarization. And yet, when we ask people a question that is not tainted by saying Republicans or Democrats, it's just formed in, here are the numbers, and what kind of society do you want to live in? The answers come out quite close. And for me, that's kind of the optimistic outcome of all this, as in fact, as a society, I think we're much more similar to each other than the political arena plays out, how it looks like.
You learn something new every day. Dan Ariely teaches behavioral economics at Duke University. Dan, thanks a lot.
My pleasure.
Many state budgets out there are in only slightly better shape than our national finances, and as a result, a lot of different kinds of people are feeling the pain. Social services and support mechanisms for disabled or low-income families are being cut. Infrastructure repair projects, at least the ones that aren't getting stimulus money, aren't getting done. And education is getting squeezed at a time of rising demand. While enrollment is growing, students at some schools are getting waitlisted for classes by the hundreds because there's no money to pay for extra faculty or staff. Much as in the business world, though, one school's problems are another school's opportunities, as Marketplace's Caitlin Carroll reports.
On a wooded hillside about 10 miles south of San Francisco sits the tiny Notre Dame de Namur University. The name's tough to pronounce, but more students are calling the school home since the recession hit.
For Notre Dame, since about 2003, overall enrollment had been declining. And then starting in fall 2008, we've seen an uptick. And right now, we're at our highest enrollment in 5 years.
Hernan Buccelli is vice president of enrollment. He says Notre Dame de Namur's student body has grown by 200 students since 2008. That's a lot for a school of only 1,600. Small private colleges like Notre Dame are capitalizing on the crisis in public education. They're pulling in students who can't get into state schools or get the classes they need to graduate on time. Notre Dame's running print ads and radio spots, emphasizing the school's convenience and its evening programs.
Notre Dame de Namur University can help you finish your bachelor's degree in the evening in business, liberal studies, and social sciences.
There are more than 600 independent colleges in the United States. Some you may have heard of, like Reed College in Oregon and Pomona College in California. Some you may not have, like St. Bonaventure in New York and Hastings College in Nebraska. many of the lesser-known schools are trying to attract students with television contests, textbook giveaways, and social networking.
Hello. Hi. I'm Sarah.
I caught up with high school junior Sarah Lemp and her parents at Notre Dame. They let me tag along on their campus tour.
Our campus is actually a historical landmark of California, and it was also on the Travel Channel for top 10 most haunted places in California. Haunted, yes.
The main administrative building from the 1800s is a little spooky. The rest of the campus is more modern. As we walk past the library, Sarah tells me that she really wants to go to San Diego State, a public school, but she's worried about getting in and about getting out.
That's what I've heard. It's hard to get classes, and it's also hard. I've heard that it's gotten harder to transfer to UC State.
Her mom, Jennifer, is worried about the tuition at Notre Dame. It's about $27,000 a year. San Diego State's around $8,000. But Lemp still thinks Notre Dame might be a better fit for her daughter.
She wants to get through in, you know, 4 years, and it doesn't happen at Cal State.
Students who turn to private schools also may have access to a bigger pool of scholarship money and aid. Richard Ekman is the president of the Council of Independent Colleges.
Private colleges and universities have enormous amounts of private financial aid money available, so that it is much more affordable than many people assume.
Lots of schools cut tuition by thousands of dollars as soon as students enroll.
Yet the stereotypes persist that the private colleges are only for wealthy kids. It's simply not true.
Brian O'Rourke has dealt with that stereotype a lot. He's the director of admissions and recruitment at Holy Names University, another small college in Northern California.
Last year I did an evening for a public high school, where they broke us out into different rooms, and I literally for 2 hours did not have one family come into the room to hear about private schools.
This year, dozens of families lined up to ask questions. O'Rourke says it's because of high school and community college counselors. A lot of them have been struggling to place students in the overloaded public system, and they're finally paying attention to small schools like his.
You know, I'm happy to say I think that's making our job a little bit easier, because more people know we exist now.
And getting noticed is a big first step after years of being invisible. In San Francisco, I'm Caitlin Carroll for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by CSX, whose trains move a ton of freight 436 miles on 1 gallon of fuel to help reduce fuel consumption. CSX, how tomorrow moves. And by Putnam Investments, seeking new ways to reduce the effects of market volatility for investors. This is Putnam Today. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
A couple of final notes today. First of all, from Dubai, we mentioned last month that the world's tallest building had finally opened there, the 2,717-foot-tall Burj Khalifa. Well, apparently it's closed again. Electrical problems, it seems. Seeing as how the building is mostly empty, though, the biggest group of losers is probably the tourists who shelled out $27 for a trip to the observation deck. Also, Toyota, as rumors of another recall loom, this one of Priuses, perhaps tomorrow. Toyota dealers in 5 southern states have had enough. They have pulled their ads from local ABC stations, saying that their coverage of the recalls has been excessive. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media this Monday afternoon. Today, the Dow dropped 103 points, 1% below 10,000 for the first time since November. The Nasdaq off 15 points, 7/10%. The S&P 500 down 9 points, 9/10%. Our producers include Caitlin Carroll, Millie Jefferson, Megan Larson, and Fiona Ng. You can tune in tomorrow morning to the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest in business and economic news. And next time on the big broadcast, just who should regulate health insurers?
Any effort by 2 insurers to go out to some bar and grill somewhere and sit down and agree on prices would be a violation of state law and would be prosecuted by the states.
I'm Kai Rizdal. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.